Hello, and welcome to another podcast brought to you by AIRS LA, the audio internet rating service of Los Angeles. My name is Nancy Porter, and it is my pleasure to bring you readings from Time Magazine. To begin with, I need to let you know you're listening to a recording provided for the use of the blind and print impaired. Items read on AIRS LA are the copyright property of the original authors and publishers. No unauthorized use or duplication is permitted. I'm going to be sharing articles from the August 18th, 2025 issue, which is the last issue I have. And we're going to begin with the health matters from that magazine. We're on page 20, and we're going to start with the DC brief by Philip Elliott. Over the third weekend of July, a lot of institutional Washington suddenly and enthusiastically discovered James Tallarico, a seminary student and member of the Texas State House. The find came during an impressive outing for the 36-year-old Democrat on Joe Rogan's podcast, in which the aspiring preacher espoused the same brand of sharp sound bites that has earned him almost a million TikTok followers. Over more than 2 hours, Tallarico explained why a Texas law requiring the posting of the Ten Commandments in public school classrooms is unchristian, how coming political fights won't be about left or right, but rather the top and bottom of society, and how both parties get it wrong when they treat politicians like messianic figures. James Tallarico, you need to run for president, Rogan said. We need someone who is actually a good person. For now, he is seen as a dark horse candidate to challenge Senator John Cornyn's already dicey re-election bid in Texas, where a scandal-soaked Attorney General Ken Paxton may plausibly land an endorsement from Donald Trump for his primary challenge. Paxton is ahead in polling and better liked among Texas MAGA base, but Cornyn, who's held his seat since 2002 and is still a power center in the upper chamber, is seen as a stronger candidate in the general election. But to zoom out, the last time a Democrat won statewide in Texas was 1994, a year before Windows 95 hit the market. Texas is in a record dry spell. The 48% of the vote Beto O'Rourke won in his 2018 Senate campaign set the recent high water mark. And to his credit, Cornyn is a far less divisive figure than O'Rourke's opponent, Senator Ted Cruz. And to his credit, Tallarico sounds different from the partisans in Washington. I think we need to start listening to Democrats who are in red and purple states. There is something about living in a red state that makes you different from a national Democrat who lives in a blue city on the coast. I think we learn how to talk with people outside our party is in a more effective way because it's a matter of political survival out here, Tallarico told Rogan. I can't pass anything in the Texas legislature without getting Republican support. So I've had to find ways to build relationships and build bridges across partisan divides as a Texas Democrat. His study of theology is not a natural fit in the secular democratic identity of late. His fluency on digital platforms may mesh neatly with a relatively younger cohort of Democrats who finally seem to be meeting voters where they are on social platforms, while the old guard clings to a 1990s playbook rooted in TV ads and postcards. And Tallarico is so far outside the splash zone of partisan Washington that he might just be able to stand unstained by its ugliness. After all, Barack Obama went from the Illinois State Senate to a national ticket in 4 horrid years. But that so many Democrats spent a weekend obsessing over a relative unknown in Austin, who represents about 200,000 people in a deep blue district, shows the extent of their desperation. All right, the next article is on page 21, and its headline is In the Loop by Billy Parrigo. He is a correspondent for Time magazine. You can measure time in the world of AI by the cadence of new essays with provocative titles. Another one arrived in July from the team at Mechanize Work, a new startup that is trying to automate all human labor. Its title, Sweatshop Data is Over. The essay points to a very real trend in AI research. To summarize, AI systems used to be relatively unintelligent. To teach them the difference between, say, a cat and a dog, you would need to give them lots of different labeled examples of cats and dogs. The most cost-effective way to get those labels was from the global south, where labor is cheap. But as AI systems have gotten smarter, they no longer need to be told basic information, the authors argue. They say AI companies are now desperately seeking expert data, which necessarily comes from people with PhDs who won't put up with poverty wages. Teaching AIs these new capabilities will require the dedicated efforts of high-skilled specialists working full-time, not low-skilled contractors working at scale. It's true that the big money has indeed moved toward expert data. A clutch of companies, including Mechanize Work, are jostling to dominate the space, which could eventually be worth hundreds of billions of dollars. Many of them are not just hiring experts, but are also building dedicated software environments to help AI learn from experience at scale in a paradigm known as reinforcement learning with verifiable rewards. It takes inspiration from Google DeepMind's 2017 model, AlphaZero, which didn't need to observe humans playing chess and instead became superhuman just by playing against itself millions of times. In the same vein, these companies are trying to build software that would allow AI to self-play with the help of experts on questions of coding, science, and math. If they can get that to work, it could potentially unlock major new leaps in capability. All of this, however, does not mean that sweatshop data has gone away. We don't observe the workforce of data workers, in the classical sense, decreasing, says Milagros Michelli, a researcher at the Weizenbaum Institute in Berlin. Quite the opposite. Meta and TikTok, for example, still rely on contractors all over the world to remove harmful content from their systems, a task that has stubbornly resisted full AI automation. Other types of low-paid tasks, typically carried out in places like Kenya, the Philippines, and India, are booming. Right now, what we are seeing is a lot of what we call algorithmic verification. People checking in on existing AI models to ensure that they are functioning according to plan, Michelli says. The funny thing is, it's the same workers. If you talk to people, they will tell you this. I have done content moderation. I have done data labeling. Now I am doing this. All right, we move now into the world of politics. We're on page 28. Headline, How Mike Johnson Became Trump's Speaker. This was written by Eric Cortellesa and Nick Popley in Washington, D.C. Don't you ever want revenge? Donald Trump asked Mike Johnson. It was late May, and the president was in the speaker's office venting about House Republicans who were standing in the way of his signature tax and spending legislation, the so-called One Big Beautiful Bill. Trump was half kidding, but he expected allegiance, not agitation. Johnson explained that seeking revenge cut against his Christian faith. When the president gave him a stone-faced look, the speaker offered a more practical reason. With a narrow majority, vendettas are not an option. We don't have the luxury, he told Trump. Johnson became Speaker of the House in October of 2023, emerging from relative obscurity to take what one of Boehner calls the toughest job in America. It requires managing a conference that has for years been nearly ungovernable, while pleasing a president who expects total obeisance and tends to turn on congressional leaders who do not deliver on his demands. Expectations for Johnson in Washington were low, but he has defied them. Since Trump's inauguration, Johnson has shepherded a series of wins for the White House, thwarting a vote blocking Trump's sweeping tariffs, passing the Lake and Riley Act, expediting the deportation of arrested immigrants, averting the government shutdown, and delivering pro-crypto legislation that blesses certain digital assets tied to the U.S. dollar. Trump's mega bill was on a different scale. A nearly $4 trillion supply-side bet that lower taxes for big business and the rich can stimulate enough economic growth to offer dramatic cuts in basic services for the poor. It slashes support to states for their Medicaid and food stamp programs and enforces work requirements that could strip health care coverage from an estimated 11.8 million people. It allocates $170 billion to complete a southern border wall and turbocharge Trump's deportation operations. The Congressional Budget Office estimates that the One Big Beautiful Bill Act will add $3.4 trillion or more to the national debt over the next decade. Johnson, however, argues it will do the opposite. In the weeks before it came to a vote, polls showed that more than half of Americans were against it. But Johnson got it done. It was very methodical, step by step, the Louisiana native tells Time magazine on July 8th, sitting in his ornate Capitol office where a framed LSU football jersey with Mr. Speaker on the back hangs behind his desk. It took quiet negotiations with competing House factions, a high-stakes roll of the dice on the House floor, and, most of all, leveraging Trump's popularity to pressure dissenters. Getting the One Big Beautiful Bill across the finish line, Vice President J.D. Vance tells Time, was a defining moment of his speakership. As speaker, Johnson is not a pugilist like Newt Gingrich, nor an iron-fisted vote counter like Nancy Pelosi. As he sees it, Trump won the presidency with a mandate to reshape government, and his role is to execute that vision. Johnson has given the president what he previously lacked, a speaker willing to turn the House into an instrument of Trump's agenda. We are a well-oiled machine now, Johnson says. That is a very different dynamic than what took place in Trump's first term. That dynamic, critics say, compromises traditional Republican principles and surrenders the independent power of Congress to placate the president. Is he a rubber stamp or Speaker of the House? Democratic Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of New York tells Time magazine. Johnson has landed Congress's has handed Congress's constitutional authority to impose tariffs and approve acts of war to the White House, while looking the other way as Trump ignores the law it passed banning TikTok in the U.S. He also sent his members home a day early to defuse a fight over releasing files about the deceased sexual predator Jeffrey Epstein, whose past relationship with the president has led to a rift within Trump's base. But Johnson has succeeded in Trump's GOP in part by aligning the legislative branch behind Trump's goals. It's a collaboration that is changing America. Not long before he squeaked Trump's mega bill through the House, Johnson feared it all might fall apart. Trump and Johnson had set a July 4th deadline to sign the measure into law. Around 2 a.m. on July 3rd, the speaker was still 9 votes shy of clearing a major hurdle of passing a rule setting terms for consideration of the bill on the House floor. Tucked in his private hideaway office in the Capitol, Johnson got word from a lieutenant that they might be able to win over an unlikely agitator, Representative Thomas Massie of Kentucky. Johnson was skeptical. Massie was such a perpetual thorn in the side of the GOP that House leaders didn't bother to whip his vote anymore. But when Representative Tim Burchett brought him into Johnson's office, Massie was willing to deal. He told Johnson that the attack ads Trump's super PAC had been running against him in his own district were devastating, according to multiple sources familiar with the exchange. He was open to advancing the bill, though not for its final passage, in exchange for a truce. Johnson got Trump on the phone, and the trio struck a compromise, the sources say. Massie would vote for the rules package, and Trump would stop the ads. Massie's office did not respond to multiple requests for comment. With Massie on board, the procedural motion passed on the House floor an hour later, setting the stage for the bill to pass. Johnson had prayed for such a breakthrough hours earlier in the Capitol Chapel with his wife. For the speaker, the product of an unplanned pregnancy, religion has long been a cornerstone of his life. His parents, who were high school sweethearts, raised in the Catholic Church, rejected the advice of friends to have an abortion. When Johnson was a 12-year-old growing up in Shreveport, his father, Pat, a firefighter, was called to a coal storage plant because of an anhydrous ammonia leak. An explosion erupted inside the facility, engulfing both Pat Johnson and his partner in flames. Pat Johnson suffered severe burns. At the hospital, doctors gave him a 5% chance of survival. His son dropped to his knees to pray that God spare his father. After dozens of surgeries, Pat Johnson defied the odds. God kind of miraculously saved his life, the speaker says. Faith became a very real thing to me. Johnson became the first member of his family to attend college and stayed at LSU for law school. He became a constitutional lawyer, working on religious liberty cases and causes connected to the Christian right. In 2004, for instance, he defended a Louisiana constitutional amendment defining marriage as between a man and a woman. Then, in 2015, a Louisiana state representative called to say he was leaving his office for a judgeship and suggested Johnson make a bid for the seat. Johnson ran unopposed. He had been in the gig for only a few months when then Congressman John Fleming called to say he was running for the U.S. Senate and urged Johnson to replace him. Johnson emerged from a field of seven opponents, entering Congress in January of 2017, the same month that Trump first took the oath of office. One morning that April, Johnson answered a call from an unknown number. "Is this Congressman Johnson?" a woman asked. "The president would like to speak with you." Johnson braced for a tough exchange. Trump had been trying to repeal the Affordable Care Act. Earlier in the week, Johnson told Speaker Paul Ryan that he would not support the measure because it was projected to raise health care costs in his district by 30%. Trump didn't wait to get past the pleasantries. "Mike, you're going to be a yes on this bill," he said, according to Johnson. As the freshman tried to explain his position, Trump cut him off. "Mike, you're going to be a yes." But Johnson refused until his amendments were added. Far from starting a feud with Trump, Johnson says the episode laid a groundwork for their future partnership. "I think he actually respected that I had that resolve," Johnson says. Because of his legal background, the freshman secured a spot on the White House Judiciary Committee. When Trump faced his first impeachment in 2019, he offered Johnson a place on his legal defense team. The next year, Johnson was one of the 147 Republicans in Congress who voted to overturn the result of the 2020 election and declare Trump the winner. When Trump was impeached a second time for inciting the January 6th attack on the Capitol, Johnson again served on his impeachment defense team. His profile in Congress was rising. Having served as chair of the Republican Study Committee, a powerful group of House conservatives, and then becoming vice chair of the Republican Conference. But he was still relatively unknown until Florida Representative Matt Gaetz orchestrated the ouster of Republican Speaker Kevin McCarthy in October of 2023. One by one, ambitious House Republicans stepped up and took their shot to succeed McCarthy. Conference leaders rallied around Steve Scalise, then Jim Jordan, then Tom Emmer. None could muster enough votes. For 3 weeks, the job remained open. The situation was becoming untenable. The Democrats and Republicans alike wanted to send aid to Israel after Hamas attacked Israel on October 7th, but they couldn't pass legislation without a speaker. Johnson emerged as an unlikely unity candidate, a low-profile figure with few enemies in a fractious conference. After winning an internal poll by the GOP caucus, Johnson went on to win the speakership on the fourth round of voting. One of the last tenured members to ever hold the job, he was suddenly third in line to the presidency. "Becoming speaker," Johnson says now, was like being elected mayor of a town that had been hit by a nuclear bomb. The challenges came immediately. Johnson passed an aid package to Israel and Ukraine, overcoming objections from members of his own party. Despite teaming up with Democrats to deliver the requisite votes, he pacified an unobstreperous group that had booted his more than seasoned predecessor after only 10 months. His temperament has served him well. He's a patient guy. He listens, and members trust him. That is the essential ingredient to being a successful speaker, says Boehner, who knows as well as anyone the challenges of corralling the House GOP. For a guy who doesn't drink, smoke, or cuss, he's a very affable guy. Representative Andy Ogles, Johnson's Capitol Hill roommate before he became speaker, notes that he is hands-on, taking the criticism, taking notes, and then trying to come to a solution. It doesn't hurt, Ogles adds, that Johnson can defuse tension with a good Trump impression. In February of 2024, Johnson traveled to Mar-a-Lago to meet with Trump and his top advisors and devise a playbook to advance his goals through Congress if he won the election. The key was to package Trump's agenda items into reconciliation bills, budget-related measures that need only a simple majority to pass. In the months that followed, as Trump hit the trail, Johnson and his aides worked on the details. We planned this very carefully over that long period, Johnson says. Weeks after Trump's election, on New Year's Day of 2025, Johnson joined congressional allies and campaign advisors in one of the dining rooms of Trump's Palm Beach mansion. Trump wanted to move quickly to make his 2017 tax cuts permanent, finish the southern border wall, and deport millions of migrants. He went around the room soliciting reactions. Trump's inner circle, including incoming White House Chief of Staff Susie Wiles, close confidant Stephen Miller, and Vance, were among those who floated breaking up this sweeping legislative agenda into two or three separate bills, according to three people present. Senate Republican leaders, such as Majority Leader John Thune and Senator Lindsey Graham, were also publicly pushing for multiple measures. Johnson argued the opposite. If we break it up, we will do parts of it, and the other parts will never get done, he told Trump. The president sided with Johnson. He wanted the bill passed in the House by Memorial Day. Trump and Johnson quickly cleared procedural hurdles that had blocked past Congresses, funding the government in March and passing a budget framework in April to advance the reconciliation bill. To win over moderate Republicans in purple districts, they raised the cap on the federal deduction for state and local taxes, known as SALT, to $40,000 a year. But blue state Republicans were hardly the only impediment. The bill irked various GOP factions, from deficit hawks to economic populists. The CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, said it would balloon the deficit, offsetting a fraction of the costs through deep cuts to Medicaid, food benefits, and clean energy investments. Even many diehard Trump supporters grimaced, fearful of punishment at the polls. There's a lot of Make America Great Again on Medicaid, said Stephen Bannon, Trump's former chief strategist. The world's richest man was another wild card. Johnson says he collaborated with Elon Musk on the legislation during Musk's tenure running the Department of Government Efficiency. Then Musk called in early June, Johnson says, as electric vehicle tax credits were on the brink of being eliminated. He was concerned about the electric vehicle mandate going away, Johnson recalls, saying Musk asked for a reprieve. Elon, it's a little late, Johnson says, he told him. We've already passed the bill out of the House, and I was under the impression that you had fully endorsed all of this. Musk did not respond to multiple requests for comment. When Musk called the president, it did not go well, according to sources familiar with the discussion. The day after, Musk unleashed a tirade against the president on social media. Johnson says he was in the Oval Office when Musk lobbed the first round of attacks and tried unsuccessfully to dissuade Trump from responding in kind. With Musk threatening to fund primary challenges against Republicans who voted for the bill, the fate of the legislation hung in the balance. It complicated things initially, Johnson says. Many Republicans shared Musk's concerns, but in the end, few wanted to get crosswise with Trump. After the Senate tweaked the bill, Johnson rushed it back onto the floor. The longer it delayed, the more negotiation, the more demands of everybody, it would have been impossible, he says. Johnson and Trump's aides began working the holdouts, who were led by Representative Andy Harris of Maryland, the chair of the right-wing House Freedom Caucus. The talks were no longer about the specifics of the legislation. They were about what the members could get in exchange for supporting it. Most wanted Trump to commit to signing a suite of cost-cutting orders. Then they wanted Johnson to codify them. Others wanted more bills to cut the debt down the road. By midnight on July 2nd, they were still deadlocked. Johnson made a gamble, scheduling a procedural vote on the rule before he had the numbers to pass it. The high-stakes tactic had worked before on Trump's budget resolution and Ukraine aid. The thinking, he says, was to put the holdouts in a pressure cooker, facing the threat of Trump's ire. He's willing to really play hardball with his own internal dissenters, says Francis Lee, a congressional scholar at Princeton University. He uses Trump's popularity and his own procedural authority to really put the screws to them. The deal with Massey was the last hurdle. At 3:23 a.m., the vote passed, effectively assuring the bill would get to the president's desk for his signature. Inside the speaker's lobby outside the House chamber, Representative Dick Allen of Georgia lifted Johnson off his feet in a bear hug. "Only you can do this job," Allen cried. After 14 months of planning and preparation, Johnson had gotten Trump what he wanted. When Trump signed the bill into law on July 4th, Johnson gave the president a memento to mark the triumph, his speaker's gavel. 2 weeks later, Johnson delivered more wins for Trump, a $9 billion recession bill gutting foreign aid and public broadcasting, and the first ever law regulating cryptocurrencies, a win for the tech bro constituency that had helped sweep Trump back to power. Johnson quashed a rebellion from his right flank over the crypto bill. Some Republicans wanted additional legislation to give crypto oversight to a friendly regulatory agency and ban the Federal Reserve from issuing its own digital currencies. To win them over, Johnson passed the first on the floor, sending it to the Senate, and promised to include the second in must-pass legislation later in the year. For now, he told them, they needed to give Trump something to herald Crypto Week at the White House. There are other battles still to come. Funding the government ahead of the September 30th deadline and passing the National Defense Authorization Act. But the heavy lifting is done for now. The 2026 midterms will test whether voters reward or penalize Johnson's loyalty to Trump. While many of the safety net cuts in Trump's signature legislation will not take effect until after the next election, some conservatives are skeptical that the popularity of tax cuts can overcome the unpopularity of less money for Medicaid and the economic disruption Trump has created through his tariffs. By reducing revenue and increasing spending on marquee MAGA priorities, critics say, Trump's big, beautiful bill comes at a steep cost to both the social contract and the nation's long-term economic health. Over time, fiscal conservatives warn, the federal government will spend more on interest paying down the debt than on national defense, with taxpayer dollars converting past borrowing rather than funding current need. While Democrats plan to run against the legislation in the midterms, Lee says the verdict remains an open question. Surveys find that most respondents disapprove of the bill, but that it has components that are popular, from tax breaks to enhanced border security. Johnson argues it will help Republicans on the campaign trail. We're going to be talking about it, he says. We can defend it. Johnson anticipates more challenges from his cantankerous colleagues. Already, there are signs of cracks. Even after Johnson brokered a truce between Trump and Massey, the Kentucky Republican has ramped up his attacks on both men, accusing them of suppressing the Epstein files. He's the only guy that could do this because he's a nice guy, the president said of Johnson recently at a White House meeting, according to two sources who had been present. I couldn't do this. Trump could not tolerate the criticism or the insubordination. He could not take a punch without counterpunching. In contrast, Johnson is willing to absorb the opprobrium, mediate the meltdowns, and hold together a fractured conference. He is both a punching bag and a psychiatrist for House Republicans who face the choice of either backing the president's agenda or losing their job. As always, Trump's favor has limits. Johnson has the president's backing only as long as he is loyal and productive. If the speaker stumbles, if he fails to deliver the votes, fails to stifle dissent or make chaos work to Trump's advantage, he risks the same fate as his predecessors. And even if Trump doesn't turn on him, voters may. A blue wave, or maybe even a ripple, would force him out of the speaker's office. On July 18th, Johnson hopped into the back seat of his armored car for the brisk ride to the White House for the bill signing. Sirens blared as the motorcade whizzed down Pennsylvania Avenue. It's cool for about half a day, Johnson says of the spectacle. In the aftermath of a vote on Trump's mega bill, he recalls, one of his colleagues said to him, "Are you proud that you made history?" Johnson laughed. "No," he said, "I'm so tired of making history." And we will stop there. And that will end our coverage of the August 18th, 2025 issue of Time Magazine. I need to remind you again that you have been listening to a recording provided for the use of the blind and print impaired. Items read on AirsLA are the copyright property of the original authors and publishers, and no unauthorized use or duplication is permitted. Again, my name is Nancy Porter, and it has been my pleasure to share Time Magazine with you.